Today is November the 11th, 2020. In December of 2000, Congress passed a law requiring Americans to pause at 3 p.m. local time to remember and honor the fallen. Congress called on the people of the United States in a symbolic act of unity to observe a national moment of remembrance to honor the men and women of the United States who died in the pursuit of freedom and peace. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Twitter, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Microsoft may have dropped support for Office 2010, but there are alternatives. Microsoft have moved on from Office 2010, then to Office 2013, then to Office 2016, and now to Office 2019. I never upgraded from 2010 because all those features that they extended is something I don't use or use frequently. At the end of October, Microsoft dropped support for Office 2010. For me, I don't like the concept of software as a service, which is their latest offering of Office 365. They have, however, made Office 2019 as a standalone product, not needing to be online for use. But it is only a subset of Office 365. At this point, I have the following options. Continue to use Office 2010 without support, which is probably not likely. Accept a new concept of software as a service and not as a one-time charge for use. Leasing services have a tendency to slowly creep up until the sticker price hits you. I've considered LibreOffice or OpenOffice. They are fully functional, but there are navigational nuances that are different. Since I work with many organizations who do use Microsoft Office, I did not pursue it. I can also switch over to WPS, which was originally Kingsoft. If you're only using Word, Excel, and PowerPoint, this would be a viable alternative. But if your organization is locked into using Outlook, you have no other choice but pay the piper. Now, there is another option. There is a micro-patching outfit, Opatch, offering security patching. Opatch has previously offered security fixes for problems with Internet Explorer and Windows 7, either before Microsoft has been able to do so, or after the company has stopped offering support for a particular product. Now Opatch has done it again, announcing that it has security adopted Office 2010. This version of Microsoft's iconic Office suite is, as of October, no longer officially supported, but Opatch says it will help users secure against vulnerabilities with its micropatches. While the micropatches will be generally only be made available to paying Opatch customers with a Pro or Enterprise subscription, the company says that they may occasionally decide to provide some of these micropatches to Opatch free users as well. For instance, to help slow down a global worm outbreak. You will, however, need to ensure that you have the very latest version of Office 2010 installed, along with all available official updates. Opatch has security adopted Windows 7 and Server 2008 Release 2 when they reach end of support in January of 2020. Since then, they've issued micropatches for 21 high-risk vulnerabilities in these systems. With Office 2010 having reached end of support last month, and many organizations expressing interest in keeping it secure, they've decided to security adopt Office 2010 as well. How does this work? Similarly to what they do for Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008 Release 2, they collect vulnerability information for Office 2010 from a variety of sources, partners, security community, public sources, and also by testing if newly discovered vulnerabilities affecting still supported Office versions might also affect Office 2010. When they come across a vulnerability that, in their assessment, represents a high risk and have sufficient data to reproduce it, they create a micropatch for it and works on fully updated Office 2010. Just as for Windows 7 and Server 2008 Release 2, Office 2010 has to be updated with the latest available official updates, that is to say, October 2020 updates. For me, it's a question of cost-benefit. If the cost is reasonable and compares more favorable to the monthly lease expenses of Office 365, it's a viable alternative. Older Android phones won't support many security websites by September 2021. You might have to upgrade your Android phones before long if you want to visit large portions of the secure web. According to Android Police Certificate Authority, Let's Encrypt is warning that phones running Android versions before 7.1.1 Nougat won't trust its root certificates starting in 2021, locking them out of many secure websites. The organization will stop default cross-signing for the certificate that enables this functionality on January 11, 2021, and it will drop the cross-signing partnership entirely on September 1st next year. A partial workaround is available by installing Firefox. Mozilla is a partner in Let's Encrypt and using its own certificate store, but that won't help with rival clients or functionality beyond browsers. It is entirely common for developers to drop support for older operating systems. However, this could be a sore point given Android update policies. Let's Encrypt noted that about 33.8% of Android users on Google Play run a version older than 7.1, and some hardware vendors cut off support early. It wasn't uncommon for Android vendors to offer relatively few updates in previous years, and some devices, typically budget phones, would even be stuck with their shipping operating system. You may have bought a phone in 2016 or even 2017, but that could abruptly lose access to some websites, at least without workarounds. The situation's improving. Samsung and other Android makers are committing to 3 years of OS updates. That won't change the reality for many people with older hardware, though, and there may be a few recourses if you can't or won't use Firefox. Even though many other sites will keep working, the inconsistent support could be a hassle, at the least, and a major obstacle at worst. Windows 10 has a new bug that's crashing PCs with Thunderbolt ports. The problem occurs when an external, non-volatile memory solid-state drive is plugged in. Windows 10 has another nasty little gremlin that causes a PC to crash with a blue screen of death, and as a result, some people have been blocked from upgrading to the May 2020 update or October 2020 update, which are the affected versions of the operating system. As described by Microsoft in a support document, the bug happens when the user plugs in an external non-volatile memory solid-state drive, otherwise known as NVMe SSD, into a Thunderbolt port, so obviously this only affects people who have the latter connector on their machine, as well as Windows 10's driver related to NVMe SSDs. Microsoft explained that an incompatibility issue has been found with Windows 10 version 2004 or Windows 10 version 20H2, which happens to be the two upgrades for this year, when using a Thunderbolt NVMe solid-state drive. On affected devices, when plugging in a Thunderbolt NVMe SSD, you might receive a stop error with a blue screen and a message that an illegal DMA operation was attempted by a driver being verified. At any rate, Microsoft says it's working on a resolution for the problem, and the software giant is hopeful that a fix can be delivered soon. That being the case, the upgrade block will be lifted, and these Windows 10 PCs will be allowed to install the latest update. Why not, in the meantime, just stop using an external, non-volatile memory solid-state drive? What is Thunderbolt technology? Thunderbolt technology originally began in the late 2000s as an Intel project called LightPeak, which was intended to add optical data transfer to traditional data transfer used with computer peripherals, principally combining wire and fiber optics. Engineers soon found that their prototypes with standard copper wiring were already achieving the results Intel wanted, but at a much lower cost. This new product was then released as Thunderbolt, and at first available only on Apple devices. Designed to be an incredibly powerful and flexible connection compared to the often brand-specific cables floating around back then. This was an impressive creation suitable for many purposes. It was particularly promising for designers or engineers who were using laptops but still needed high-powered connections to external storage, high-resolution displays, and similar accessories. Since the first Thunderbolt release made it out of the door with some help from Apple, it was only available for Macs for the first year or so. In addition to limited availability, this new tech required unique Thunderbolt cables, and they tended to be expensive, about $50 or so. Technology marched on, though, and time had provided a more accurate look at how Thunderbolt was being used and where it should head in the future. The arrival of Thunderbolt 2 in June of 2013 brought several significant changes to Thunderbolt technology. For one, it enabled simultaneous file data and video data transfers, what Intel called a lot of eye-popping video and data capability. Another significant change was compatibility with the latest DisplayPort standards and 4K. While still a little ahead of its time, 4K resolution was on the horizon, and users were dependent on Thunderbolt connections were glad to know that the highest solutions would be supported when necessary. Also crucially for users, Thunderbolt 2 devices worked with the original Thunderbolt compatible devices, even if you wanted to mix and match different generations. Again, Thunderbolt would remain an Apple exclusive using the mini DisplayPort connector until the following generation. The Thunderbolt 3 standard was announced in June of 2015 and immediately declared a match made in heaven. Devices supporting Thunderbolt 3 through the USB-C connector followed in December. What is Thunderbolt 3? Championed by Apple, Intel's Thunderbolt technology has been around since 2009, and however, by the time Thunderbolt 3 showed up in 2016, times had changed. USB-C has emerged as the newest USB connector, complemented by an updated and powerful USB cable that could provide up to 15 watts of power for devices, far more than older standards, and up to 100 watts for charging compatible laptops or similar devices. It was a considerable change for both USB and the future of many standard computer connections. In response, Thunderbolt's architect made a brilliant decision. Rather than face off against USB-C, they joined it. Thunderbolt 3 ditched the old mini display port connector and switched to a USB-C connector, combining the two technologies into one particularly robust hybrid. The move to USB-C allowed Thunderbolt 3 to expand from Apple's devices to other PCs and laptops, a process that is ongoing but finally possible. The only downside was the issue of compatibility. Thunderbolt 3's new USB-C connection isn't compatible to devices based on Thunderbolt or Thunderbolt 2 without an expensive adapter. Well, here are some of the things you can do with Thunderbolt 3 port today. Transmit data at a rate of up to 40 gigabits per second, depending, of course, on the configuration. Output video to two 4K monitors at 60 hertz. Charge smartphones and most laptops with up to 100 watts of power, and connect to an external GPU, of course, depending on the configuration. If you're wondering whether or not your USB-C port supports Thunderbolt 3, look for the little lightning bolt symbol next to the opening, which differentiates it from a standard USB-C port. The latest Thunderbolt developments. Just as the original Thunderbolt and Thunderbolt 2 have gone out of fashion, the updates to Thunderbolt 3 will continue. charging devices through USB-C connections has become more common, and compatibility has pressed onward to include the latest USB 3.2 cable standard. However, this is still a work in progress, and as always, double-check your cables. New technology could challenge the Thunderbolt status as the fastest connection available. For example, USB 4 standard is on its way, coming to devices as soon as 2021, and it finally promises speeds that can match Thunderbolt 3. According to official data, USB-4 will be based on Thunderbolt technology to deliver transfer speeds up to 40 gigabits per second when using certified cables. The latest standard, USB 3.2 Gen 2, can only deliver 10 gigabits per second. The competition puts pressure on Thunderbolt to keep up. Still, the Thunderbolt 3 offers more than just high-speed data communications. It's dual feature and features plenty of video bandwidth. Of course, that high-speed data also comes with a few security threats you probably don't want to overlook. Security experts recently warned of the ThunderClap vulnerability on Macs and PCs, a loophole related to giving DMA or direct memory access privileges to Thunderbolt, USB-C, and FireWire. Malicious peripherals, even adding in PCI Express cards infected in the supply chain, can bypass the security layer that manages memory access, allowing hackers to run malicious code on the PC and steal data. These security risks are particularly concerning because the Thunderbolt 3 has so much more compatibility. The MacBook Pro, Air, iMac, and Mac Mini all have a Thunderbolt 3 port. Stick to trusted devices when using your Thunderbolt 3 port and don't take the risk with something you've never used. In most cases, it's common sense. TV providers on track to lose around 5 million subscribers in 2020. The major pay TV providers saw cord cutting slowed up a little in the most recent quarter, with AT&T, Comcast, Dish, Charter, and Verizon losing a combined 735,000 subscribers during the 3 months ending in September 30th. During the third quarter of 2019, the same companies lost almost 1.4 million subscribers. However, it's not all good news for the pay TV industry. Almost 4.2 million households canceled pay TV services during the first 9 months of 2020, surpassing the 3.8 million cord cutters the five companies saw during the same time period last year. This suggests that consumers who were on the fence about ditching the cable did so earlier during the pandemic, much in the same way that Netflix saw its biggest subscriber growth during the first two quarters of the year. What's more, pay TV operators are still granting pandemic-related billing relief to hundreds of thousands of customers who would have been disconnected under normal circumstances, suggesting that we might see a big bump in cord cutting once those grace periods expire. The biggest change in the third quarter was a notable improvement for AT&T. The telco saw its losses shrink from nearly 1.2 million households to 590,000, which is largely due to a massive shedding of subscribers to its internet-based TV Now service last year. Things stayed largely the same for most of the other providers, with Comcast increasing subscriber losses by 33,000, while Verizon lost 6,000 fewer customers. Two notable winners were Dish and Charter, with the latter adding 53,000 subscribers during the quarter, while it lost 77,000 in the third quarter of last year. Dish also grew its subscriber base, albeit at a lower rate than in the third quarter of last year. The picture changes quite a bit when we zoom out and look at the year-to-date. During the first 9 months of this year, four of the five big TV providers lost more subscribers than during the same period last year. AT&T leads in total losses with 2.6 million subscriber defections. Comcast losses nearly doubled to around 1 million households. Dish faced the biggest decline of the industry, and only Charter managed a notable turnaround. It's still unclear how much the pandemic simply accelerated existing trends and whether some cord cutters will return to the fold now that sports leagues are playing again. However, any positive effects from such sports-related cord pausing is likely outweighed by the continued economic outfall of the pandemic. In the fourth quarter of last year, the industry's biggest provider lost a whopping 1.6 million pay TV subscribers. Even if the picture continues to improve for AT&T, Charter, and others, it is very likely that the Big Five will end 2020 with around 5 million fewer customers. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell and his continuing IT Pro series, Tech Training in the COVID World.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now let's take a detour into, yes, the business world, the professional world. I have a lot of experience as an IT professional, and one of the things that I really focus on is learning more. This is something that we all should be doing. And that kind of leads into this next topic I've got, which is that a lot of these different organizations have been running internal technical training over the years. But one of the really big things that we've been confronted with is, yes, this latest turn in a life's path, our current experience with, yes, COVID and coronavirus and all that. And how has this changed technical training? And the reality is a lot of companies have had to be very nimble and they've had to change the way they do things. Some companies already had foresight and forethought to move forward with computer-based training. What is this? Well, it's basically where you take the training on your computer at a convenient time for you. I've been doing this now for a very, very long time. Some of the different classes that I've taken in all kinds of various professional capacities have been on electronic computer-based training systems. They haven't been with somebody sitting, up at the front of the classroom, and I sit there and I go, I'm really bored. I'm really thinking about the wrong things at the moment. I've got, this problem going on at the office, that problem going on, whatever it is. Computer-based training is neat because if you aren't feeling particularly focused, you can pause it. If you get an emergency message, a text message saying, hey, something's not working, your attention is needed right now, you can hit the space bar or click the right spot on the screen and everything pauses. You're all set. And you can come back to that training at any point in time. This is something that many major corporations have migrated towards over the course of the many years. Some haven't, but many have. I will tell you, I work for a large company, and everything that I've done for training with them has been electronic. It's been a matter of my sitting and staring at a screen for 15 minutes, 30 minutes. Some of these are actually a little bit more in depth, a few hours, but it all is provided electronically. This allows for the same training to be delivered to people around the world. This is one of the areas which allows the same training to be given without variances based off of, okay, this teacher just is not interesting. This guy has a monotone and he goes on and on and on. Versus, of course, the other guy who is excited. He's animated. He's got all kinds of different anecdotal stories on how this is going to help you and that's going to help you. He has a different level of passion. So we take that person who has the passion and we take the information and we go, you have to cover this and this and this and this. And we give all of that, and you have to make sure that it happens very quickly. Well, there's something else that goes along with this, too. And that is, if it gets to be boring, if it gets to be too far off track, we can edit out certain sections of this training. We can streamline it to make sure that all of the different points are covered and all of the different things are said that need to be said without all of these different things of crazy questions. Or that one person who, you know, they're usually two-thirds of the way back, they haven't been paying attention. Yes, there's a question that's asked, and they've already answered this. And everybody turns, and all of the time is wasted on this one question that seems to last forever. Yes, I speak from personal experience on this. I've seen this before. But this can happen in a number of different ways. It doesn't have to be technical training. It can be business training. It can be processes training. It can be government training. I'll tell you, I have a few different certifications that have nothing to do with computing. And those different classes, yeah, I sat through them. I remember a session where I went, and it was a 3-day session. It was amazingly long, and it was paid for by one of the biggest names in aerospace. And they paid for us to go to this training, which is great. It was fine. It was boring. I took that same training a matter of a couple of years later, and the training was a computer-based training. It was done in my office, and I think it was in total 8 hours, not 3 business days, not a big, huge, long commute from, off into downtown Los Angeles. You know, it was something that really allowed me to also pause it when I needed to and ask questions if I needed to, although I didn't need to. Everything was covered in the training. In that 8 hours, I was able to hit on all of the different topics that were part of the questionnaire, quiz, the test at the end that made sure that I knew that I was a professional in this particular field that happened to be called ITAR, International Trafficking in Arms Regulations. Yeah, boring stuff, but, you know, that's what happens when you're in the aerospace industry. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Solid-state drives versus hard disk drives for speed, lifespan, and reliability. The primary reason why people replace the hard disk drive with a solid-state drive is faster loading time for the operating system and applications, along with faster running speed with the data-intensive files. But how does a solid-state drive compare with a hard disk drive for reliability and lifetime storage of files? Let's compare and contrast the solid-state drive versus the hard disk drive in each of these features. Finding the speeds of a solid-state drive or a hard disk drive can be confusing. One should not rely much on the connection speed, usually quoted at 6 gigabytes per second. While the connection speed is commonly used in the industry, a drive will not deliver those speeds. The read-write speed is the most important statistic when it comes to a hard disk drive versus solid-state drive. A typical 7200 RPM hard disk drive will deliver a read-write speed of 80 to 160 megabytes per second. On the other hand, a typical solid-state drive will deliver read-write speeds of between 200 to 550 megabytes per second. As noted, a solid-state drive can deliver a much better read-write speed compared to a hard disk drive. And when it comes to the solid-state drive versus the hard disk drive speed, the solid-state drive is the clear winner. There is a major technical difference between solid-state drive and hard disk drives. Solid-state drives function on flash memory, while hard disk drive write to a physical disk. These technical differences ensures that hard disk drives cannot compete with solid-state drive on speed. The read-write speed you will achieve when using a solid-state drive or a hard disk drive will vary depending on the model chosen. Of course, a solid-state drive with close to 550 megabytes read-write speed will cost more. For certain tasks, maximum read-write speed is not needed. For the basic PC usage, one could perhaps get away with using a lower speed drive. For most users, a drive with faster read-write speeds is recommended. Well, how about solid-state drive versus a hard disk drive for lifespan? Both solid-state drive and hard disk drives have their advantages and disadvantages when it comes to lifespan. Some assume that because solid-state drives have no moving parts, they'll last a lot longer. This is not necessarily true. Solid-state drives typically have a factory guideline for lifetime of the NAND. NAND is the technology that is used by solid-state drives. NAND cells degrade with every write on the solid-state drive. This means that if you really place new files on your drive, of course the solid-state drive will last a long time. A solid-state drive, when opened up, looks like a regular circuit board. A hard disk drive relies on moving parts for the drive to function. Every time data is written or read, the spindle is read by the mechanics within the drive. It would only take one moving part to fail to render the entire drive useless. When open, a hard disk drive contains platters, a spindle, read-write head, or heads, an actuator arm, actuator axis, and an actuator. With normal use, one would expect a solid-state drive to outlive a standard hard disk drive. A solid-state drive best uses with lifespan in mind is for frequent read-only access to the same files, such as like loading the operating system over and over again. Usage of resource-intensive programs and basic computing with minimal disk space needs. A hard disk drive best uses with lifespan in mind is when cold storage of large files is needed. In other words, massive files. Basic computing with needs for extensive hard disk space and frequent usage of data access, such as saving and deleting files. When it comes to hard disk drive versus solid state drive for reliability, reliability has advantages and disadvantages for both solid state drives and hard disk drives. In most cases, a solid state drive will be more reliable. One thing to keep in mind is a hard disk drive is easier to recover data from if ever needed. Due to the hard disk drive long enjoyment of the go-to choice for storage, there are several technologies available for data recovery. On the other hand, a solid-state drive still employs fairly new technologies. Data recovery is a much more difficult task for solid-state drives. With that said, it is imperative to keep backups of all your data, whether or not you're using a solid-state drive or a hard disk drive. Solid-state drives and hard disk drives each have their own purpose in the market. Hard disk drives still offers the least expensive cost per gigabyte. However, it's becoming more apparent that the days of the hard disk drive are numbered. As new NAND technology is developed, the need for an old spindle-based storage system will no longer be needed. One thing to consider is the speed in which computers are able to process data. Hard disk drives are limited in the possibilities of performance. Running a computer with a solid-state drive, it's much faster than a standard hard disk drive. That said, there is a case for using both solid-state drives and hard disk drives. Using a solid-state drive for the operating system and hard disk drive for file storage is becoming more common. That's known as a hybrid configuration. If you have the budget and proper backups, the benefits of using the solid-state drives are obvious. How does a solid-state drive compare to a SD flash storage card? A solid-state drive is a solid-state storage device that uses integrated circuit assemblies to store data persistently, typically using flash memory, and functioning as secondary storage in the hierarchy of computer storage. SDN or micro SD flash memory card is an electronic non-volatile computer memory storage medium that can be electrically erased and reprogrammed. The two main types of flash memory, NOR flash and NAND flash, are named after the NAND and NOR logic gates. The solid-state drive and the SD flash storage card, they sound alike. Then a question asked is, can I just run an operating system on my computer with the SD flash memory instead of a solid-state drive or a hard disk drive? The short answer is an unqualified yes. The Raspberry Pi is an example of running a computer with only an SD flash memory card. Well, with the SD flash memory card and the solid-state drive, what is really the difference? The solid-state drive operates under the same principles that other flash storage mediums use. namely non-volatile memory, which prevents memory from disappearing due to the loss of power, like a dozen RAM. Since both SD cards and solid-state drives use solid-state storage and have no moving parts, is there any notable difference between the two types of memory? Shouldn't a massive capacity SD card be just about the same thing as a small solid-state drive? Well, not quite. Not all NAND chips are equal. Flash memory is an electronic non-volatile computer memory storage medium that can be electrically erased and reprogrammed. The two types of flash memory, NOR flash and NAND flash, are named after the NAND and NOR logic gates. Flash can be used for many things in addition to solid-state drives. NAND is faster for writes and takes up significantly less space than NOR, which also makes it less expensive. Most flash used in solid-state drives is the NAND variety. NAND flash memory depends on other hardware installed on the device or embedded into the chips. A NAND cell is basically a series of semiconductors that hold data inside of them. The speed at which they read and write information is almost entirely contingent on how they are arranged and how the controllers that pick up and send the data coordinate the process. Theoretically, you could end up with an SD card that reads and writes just as fast as a solid-state drive. Most of the time, an average card will not be that fast. The limited amount of space that they provide doesn't allow manufacturers much room to maneuver and create an environment where massive amounts of data can be moved in tiny clock cycles. This is not to say that there aren't different types of NAND flash memory, each with their own advantages and disadvantages. However, you could theoretically move NAND from a solid-state drive, such as what can be found in a Samsung solid-state drive, into an SD card. For the SD format to work, it just needs to be capable of communicating with the devices that read it. Well, let's look at the differences. Since SD cards have a limited amount of space, the microcontroller that fetches storage and writes to it is usually pushed to the edge of the card. There are only so many instructions that could be programmed into a microcontroller of that size. And with such tiny infrastructure, the way an SD card handles data is rather rudimentary. It will have a tendency to store data wherever there is free space and read things as orderly a manner as possible. As larger SD capacity comes to the market, this, however, will be minimized. This isn't true of SSDs, which have the luxury of fitting all their memory and the entire infrastructure into a space that fits into the average computer drive bay. The entire infrastructure of the solid-state drive is built to ensure that no single cell is used more than the others, keeping every file operation as balanced as possible, which is what you expect from a drive that does a lot of read-write operations. The larger amount of space also allows manufacturers to insert chips that store cache data, which is crucial for managing heavy and repetitive operations quickly. No time is wasted and everything transfers fluidly. In addition to this, the added bulk of the drive allows it to dissipate more heat. This makes it capable of having more power-hungry controllers that would be unfeasible in an SD format because it both draws more power than small handheld devices could provide and heats up significantly if you're using it in a smartphone. The gist of all this is that each platform was designed to work in specific environments. SD cards are best used for storing files and playing them back, while solid-state drives are optimized for running the operating system partition of a computer and everything such a task would demand. One has a simpler role while the other needs to be smarter and more adaptable. It's not just a question of speed here, but it's also one about workflow and versatility. Well, how about the prospect of having SD cards with sufficiently complex microcontrollers that allow them to work as swappable drives or computers? We're getting there. At present, SanDisk 1TB Extreme Micro SD card is the biggest capacity that you can get in that format. It costs, however, about $450. But there are a few smaller options that are better priced yet. Samsung's 512GB micro SD card, less than $100, and alternatively, SanDisk Ultra 400GB micro SD card is below $57. If you have a low-priced PC populated with 32 gigabytes or 64 gigabytes of eMMC flash storage, you may be frustrated by the fact that almost all these systems have the flash storage soldered onto the motherboard. Using the card reader port for an SD or microSD flash card, you'll be able to extend the usage of these systems. With Black Friday having already begun with some retailers, and with all others fairly soon, computer systems with all different configurations will be featured. We have always advocated to buy what you need today, for tomorrow it will be cheaper with newer technologies. You may be able to save on the cost for a computer system equipped with 128 gigabytes or 256 gigabytes of solid-state storage and have it augmented separately with a high-capacity SD flash card for static storage of information such as audio, video, and digital photographic files. When you do need to replace the solid-state drive for a larger capacity, it will cost you less in the future. Presenting Marty Winston with a Geek Salute to Service.
At ease, to every fellow veteran who may be listening, we salute your service. To every fellow geek who may be listening, you may not have thought about it, but without veterans, we'd just now be getting into a 1990s level of technology. But let's start about a century and a quarter before that. In 1867, telegraph wires became a responsibility of a four-year-old U.S. Army unit, the Signal Corps. Wired communications and later in World War I, wireless radio communications were among its responsibilities. By World War II, they established a training site in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. You may have heard of some Signal Corps veterans. Stan Lee, Tony Randall, Frank Capra, Daryl Zanuck. There are hundreds of thousands whose names you probably don't know. But wherever technology touches your life, they were almost certainly part of getting it there. Even after leaving the Army, these veterans were instrumental in using their training to help get America wired, first for telegraphy and later for telephones. Roughly a century ago, when radios became more than playthings for a few hobbyists and started getting sold from stores, chances were good that the guy fixing them at the new radio repair shop in town also got his training in the Army. Television wasn't yet a thing for the Signal Corps in World War II. TV's first public availability was a few years later. But returning veterans found a lot of work in the factories building radios and record players and other consumer electronics of the era, and soon, television. For decades, the GI Bill helped veterans get the training they chose to help them qualify for better jobs. And there were several large correspondence schools specifically teaching electronics. Those schools spent a lot of money advertising to those veterans who showed any interest at all in electronics. Did you ever hear of Popular Electronics Magazine? It was one of several newsstand magazines to address the interests of electronic hobbyists and a favorite place for those electronic correspondence schools to advertise. By the way, it was a Ziff Davis publication, the same publisher that's behind PC Magazine and dozens of other brands you may recognize, like Mashable. But when the GI Bill financial assistance ended, it was a death knell for many of those correspondence schools and a kick in the gut to a lot of newsstand hobby magazines. Happily, there were other ways to learn. 40, 50, or 60 years ago, training outside the gates of military bases was a bigger phenomenon than most people knew. At Purdue, the only woman in my class on relativistic physics and quantum mechanics was a Navy officer who was taking the course to improve her understanding of shipboard atomic reactors. In those years, transistors were replacing vacuum tubes in many military electronic systems, and later, integrated circuits took the same path. Lasers were getting deployed. Satellite imaging was improving. communications lines were using tech tricks to get more secure, and Vietnam brought a new generation of night vision gear. During the Nam era, the largest population of enlisted or drafted people who left the military faced manifest unpopularity among the non-veteran public. Many chose to keep their heads down. A generation of veterans had to wait a generation before being comfortable just acknowledging it. But that didn't stop them from contributing. The idea of working in the geek realms was compelling, with or without a veteran's training or experience. In the general workplace, the difference might go unnoticed, but in the growing technology workplace, veterans already knew and understood things that many of their colleagues had yet to learn. Things like being dependable, like backing each other up, like uniting efforts toward a common goal. The beginning of the personal computer industry had a few big companies with large production facilities, but it also had startups all over the map that began in basements or barns and grew rapidly. As they grew, and remembering the era, they may not have sought out veterans, but they did want to avoid hiring those undependable, unreliable workers who they loosely categorized as stoners. They weren't always successful. Then again, those companies didn't always survive. When the draft ended, the nature of those serving began to shift. Those who served did so voluntarily, not reluctantly. As conflicts like those in Iraq and Afghanistan brought purpose to their service, more chose to stay in, to re-enlist, to extend their enlistment commitments. And the longer they stayed in, the longer they were exposed to the quick advancements in technology. They didn't do it because it was cool to be a geek. They did it because it let them keep in touch with their families when they were off duty, and because it gave them a much better chance of getting their missions accomplished when they were on duty. Many of those have since come home. They're everywhere. They might open shops or buy farms or work for companies or teach. And even when that's new to them, even when they don't quite know what they're doing, you'll see them get past that faster than anybody around them. It's just a matter of adapting skills to tools, something they've had to do scores of times when in uniform. For some veterans, working in uniform was just a job, maybe one they chose, maybe not. For some, it was a career. But one thing that all veterans have in common is that it's over. You did your duty, you did your service, you learned a lot of things about things, and you learned a lot of things about people, especially yourself. Early on, it's all about training. Later on, a lot of it's about wisdom. And that's kind of amazing. You have a hodgepodge of people thrown together in a way that may look random, given jobs that may seem to be beyond them, and making it all work. Because of themselves, because of each other. And that's why when you tell veterans that you salute their service, they'll almost always reply, "It was an honor to serve." Next time, there's a new round of effective standalone products that can provide UVC disinfection for desktops, small rooms, or work areas, and even elevator cars. And that means it's time to expand our UVC coverage yet one more round. Be here for our report, "Put UVC Next to Me." I'd hate to have to report you absent.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, November the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets November the 13th. That's Friday the 13th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. The Princeton PC Users Group meets Tuesday, November the 24th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. And the Brookdale Computer Users Group, well, they meet on a Thursday, and they normally meet on the fourth Thursday of each month, but it happens to be Thanksgiving Day. So go to their website to get more information as when the new date will be for the meeting. Their website is bcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. And if you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week. The origins of Remembrance Day. Remembrance Day, also called Armistice Day, is a memorial day observed by many countries of the world involved in the conflicts of World War I. In 1918, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the armistice papers were officially signed to mark the conclusion of the war. From 1919 onwards, Remembrance Day has been observed on the 11th day of November to remember and honor members of the armed forces who have died serving their country. Many services are timed to observe 1 or 2 minutes of silence at 11 a.m., and many places of work also observe some moments of silence at that time as a mark of respect. While key ceremonies take place on the anniversary date of 11th of November, other Remembrance Day services take place on the second Sunday in November, or Remembrance Sunday. In subsequent years, Remembrance Day has included those killed or injured in World War II and other later conflicts, most recently in Afghanistan. To ensure the sacrifices of America's fallen heroes are never forgotten, in December 2000, the U.S. Congress passed and the President signed into law the National Moment of Remembrance Act, creating the White House Commission on the National Moment of Remembrance. The Commission's charter is to encourage the people of the United States to give something back to their country, which provides them so much freedom and opportunity, by encouraging and coordinating commemorations in the United States of Memorial Day and the National Moment of Remembrance. We close out this program with music performed by the United States Army Field Band.